time for Newsmakers with Brent DeHart and Dave Bourne. Presented by Les Schwab Tires. It's live, local talk that matters to you. Now, here's Brent and Dave.
Hello and welcome to Newsmakers. This is Brent DeHart here with Dave Bourne. We're your noontime local issues talk show here on KYKN 1430. It is a fabulous day. I'm in a great mood. We have a great guest. It's going to be really interesting. So Mike Erdman is here with us, and Mike is a great guy. He's the CEO of the Home Builders Association, affectionately known as the HBA. The long title is Home Builders Association of Marion and Polk Counties. Mike, welcome.
Thank you.
Boy, so many things to talk about. We have things in the news to talk about, but we're going to put them off. We'll put them off to tomorrow because there's so many things in your industry I want to talk about. Dave, this is the first time you've met the home builder CEO?
Yes, I'm very interested in what's going on.
So this is, you know, well, truth be told, I love the trades. I like people in the trades. I tend to like the people that work in the trades. I'm involved in the Home Builders Association, and I have clients in my day job that are members of the Home Builders Association. But not being self-serving, I wanted to have Mike here because there's so many things that affect the Mid-Valley and the people that live in the Mid-Valley and their cost of living, their standard of living, and everything else. And there's so many things about housing, and there are very few topics more important to families than the cost of housing and what they can get and how long it takes to get there and the availability of is housing. So, Mike, so you are a membership organization, private organization.
We are.
Nonprofit.
It is.
Okay. So about how many members in the group?
Yeah, no, we've got about 700 member companies that that belong to the association. It's a voluntary membership, as you mentioned. Some folks get us mistaken for a union or a regulator. We're neither of the two. It's an organization that if somebody in the construction business thinks that we're going to provide benefit to them, then they join.
And I've said on previous shows, I'm a big proponent. I was taught that by my father of trade associations. And in fact, you're a trade association.
Absolutely.
So benefits to people who are in the trades, not just people who are contracting to be the general to build somebody's house, right?
Correct.
So everybody, you know, who potentially could assist that general might be a member.
Yeah. So as I said, we've got about 700 member companies. About a third of those are your traditional, what you'd think of as a builder, a general contractor, and about two-thirds of those are others. There could be a subcontractor, a painting contractor, a material supplier like a lumberyard, or it could be a vendor, a title company, or a bank, or a lender. We represent really as just everybody involved in the residential construction business all the way through the process from the general contractor to those that supply to them.
All right. So why do they want to be a member? What benefit is it to them?
Sure. Well, I've always said that our reason for existence is to make our members more successful in their own business. And so we do everything from advocacy on their behalf, looking out for their interests and representing them at all levels of government. We do industry education, information. We do group purchasing for them, insurance programs, anything we can do that's going to make them more successful, more profitable in their own business.
Insurance programs, that's a biggie. That, I know when you go through an industry organization, sometimes you can save a lot of money. And also you mentioned education. So how to deal with lead, how to deal with site cleanup, how to deal with erosion on a site and things like that.
Exactly. It could be compliance-based. Every contractor's got to take a certain number of hours to renew their license every couple of years. So we do those hours. But we do, as you say, we do education that helps folks comply with the lead laws. We do building codes as building codes change. We try to keep the industry updated as to what those changes are, just to keep them abreast of their own industry.
All right. But so pretty much you're these huge developers that just rape the earth, right?
Isn't that how people sometimes see
anybody who makes a living building, right?
Well, it's the great thing about the industry here in Salem is it is made up of what I'd call your artisan contractors. Our members, by and large, 98% of them are the small folks. They're working out of the house, maybe a small office. These are not global corporations. They are local small business right here in Salem and the surrounding communities.
Oh, but housing is so busy right now. Isn't everybody just raking in dough and sitting on piles of money at your expense? A bunch of rich guys, right?
I tell you what, I think folks would love to think they could be included in that group, but unfortunately, it's not the case. It's kind of surprising, in fact, since you talk about that, you look at kind of the average. What's the average margin? How much does the builder make? And you look at some of the national studies, and it's only 7 or 8% the net margin on the construction and sale of a house. So folks think that there's tons of money to be made, but wow, maybe not the case.
And that's, as a former retailer, that's not a very big margin, especially considering the number of variables and how easily something could swing in costs that you've already bid that might have gone up, regulations that change while you're in process. There are a lot of risks there that can eat away that 7 or 8%.
So, oh, boy, I tell you, it's an inherently risky business. Just talk to the folks that were around and tried to survive 10 or 12 years ago when we went through the housing recession, and folks that maybe had made that investment in land and lots and all of a sudden found that the value that they had paid for them was no longer there. So it's very much a risky business.
All right, we're talking to Mike Erdman here on Newsmakers. He's the CEO of the HBA, the Home Builders Association of the region. He's been there 27 years, so you know a thing or two. Speaking of commercials I don't really like, I don't know why people buy farmers insurance, because we've seen a thing or two. So. Right. But anyway, you know what you're talking about. So it's nice to have somebody who's been around the regulations, around the building trades for so long to talk to us. We're going to talk today about population growth, about some zoning snafus, think cost drivers for your house. Why do they cost so much? Why is it so hard to get affordable homes? We're going to talk about the Salem area market and where they're building and where they have space to build. So we'll touch a little bit on urban growth boundary and things like that. So there's a lot of things to talk about. So you're going to be, Mike, and we're going to be our first Dub and Gumbert story.
Looking forward to it.
So do we have time to do that right now, Dave?
You do. Yeah.
All right. So this is one of my favorite stories I've heard, because it's so tragic. So in Portland, exclusionary zoning.
Inclusionary zoning.
Inclusionary.
Yes.
Right. We have to include. So real quick, how did that play out?
Well, why don't we talk about what it is.
Yes, multifamily.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Exactly. So obviously the issue of housing affordability has been first and foremost on the minds of a lot of folks over the last number of years. Mm-hmm. And so this is a concept of inclusionary zoning has taken place around the country, and it is now new to Oregon. In legislation that passed a couple years ago, it allows a city to mandate that a developer of a larger multifamily project, a building that's got more than 30 units, you could mandate that they would have to set aside 20% of those units for those that earn less than 80% of the median family income. And so, of course, to do that, you have to subsidize the cost of providing the housing to those of lower incomes out of the market rate rents of everybody else.
Wow. So that's the person that builds it, or the person in it, because you build it and sell it. But if I'm going to build an apartment complex with 50 or 60 apartments, I have to sell some of them below the market.
In Portland, that would be the case. And of course, these are typically in Portland, these are rentals. Mm-hmm. And so the rents that you would be allowed to charge for that 20% of folks of the lower incomes would have to be subsidized by everybody else.
Wow. So if I sold it to you, rents would have to be the same?
Well, and they could do the same thing. So if you're doing a condo where you're actually selling the units, same thing. 20% of those units would have to be available for sale to those earning only 80% of the median family income.
Hey, Dave, let's run down to Roth's and go tell Ross what they should sell the milk for.
Right.
And make sure that they sell the milk for under cost, under market, because the government said. So how'd that play out?
Well,
how'd that work for Portland?
I think they're realizing not as well as they had hoped. And anybody with a little bit of common sense looks at it and realizes what happened. And that is, all of a sudden, the developer, the investor who was doing the project, looked at it and said, this doesn't pencil. I can't do this project. And so as the numbers I've heard, I think they had a 90% drop in permit applications for those larger multifamily projects after that rule went into place.
All right, so now we're sitting here scratching our heads, trying to figure out why there's an affordable housing shortage, why nobody can find an apartment in Portland that they can afford, scratching our heads to try to find a reason. But they put in this regulation, and the number of permits that are taken out to build new multifamily housing drops by 90%. Hello, government.
Well, and of course, what happens when you restrict the supply? that means rents go up.
Right.
And so you adopt a regulation with the thought that you're going to provide additional affordable housing, and the net effect of it is to actually raise the cost of housing across the board.
So there's less of it, and it costs a lot more. But boy, we can't figure out what happened, and what do we have to do? And let's have a whole new government program to deal with affordable housing. And
wasn't Section 8 housing supposed to take care of all that?
That's a whole nother show.
Right?
Well, it's a federal-funded program.
Right?
But everybody
contributes to. But this one mandated that the people renting in the same building, their rents were higher to subsidize the ones that the 20% that they mandated for the lower income. Right?
Well, it doesn't mandate they have to pay more, but of course for the investor who is actually building that project, the only way that you can subsidize those that are of lower income
is raise the rent
from everybody else.
Yeah. That's basically what happened then.
Dumb government stories. And of course, they're standing up and saying, hey, that didn't work. We should repeal this, right?
They are taking a look. I know there's been a lot of discussion up north about whether it had the intended effect that they were hoping for. And I think they're realizing it did not. So they're taking another look at it up north.
This is when we elect people that don't. Here's the distinction. We talk of this a lot in the business community is elect people that have signed the front of a paycheck, that have ever owned a business and can follow the sequence of events and the unforeseen consequences, not just people that spent their entire life signing the back of the paycheck as they deposit it. So
good point.
Big difference when we have our elected leaders, as we're always preaching about paying attention to who you're voting for. Hey, we've got Mike Erdman here from the HBA. We're going to be back in a minute. This is Newsmakers on 1430 KYKN, Salem's Listening.
Newsmakers continues with Brent DeHart and Dave Bourne on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
Welcome back to the Rising Sun here at KYKN Newsmakers 1430, your new time hour to talk about local issues, topics, and individuals. Here with Brent DeHart and Dave Bourne in our studio today. We've got Mike Erdman, CEO of the Home Builders Association of Marion and Polk County, the HBA, looking after its members and actually looking after all of us in terms of being able to find a house that our family can live in and afford. We were talking a little bit about government regulations and how that affects the costs. What is the market like? I mean, it seems like we've had this really hot market and they're building a lot of houses and the realtors are all busy. What's going on in the general Marion County, Polk County area and for those housing?
Yeah, and it's definitely, it's a good market right now and activity's been up. We do about 450 new homes a year in Salem this past year.
Just in the city?
Just in the city of Salem.
Buyers or sellers market?
You know, right now it has been a seller's market, but I think it is balancing out a little bit more. You know, we've been running about a 2 or 3 month supply, and I've always considered that balanced market to be right at a 6 month supply. And so numbers are going up a little bit, and so it's softening, but it is by no means a weak market. But it's getting more back in balance with where it should be. So as I mentioned, we're doing about 450 homes a year, and we think that's a lot. Everybody's busy. But, you know, Brent, I think it's interesting when you go back and look at how many homes this community built going back over the last 30 or 40 years. And I think folks would be surprised to know that our current level of activity is really only about 30% of what we were doing even back in the late 70s when this was a much smaller community.
Wow.
You know, back then, I think we were doing about 1,400 to 1,500 homes a year. You know, that dropped. We went into the early 80s. We had a bad, bad recession. You know, we came out of the recession into the late 80s, and we were doing 600-700 homes a year, and that continued to grow throughout the 90s. We were 800 homes a year. You get into the 2000s, we were 900 homes a year. And then, of course, we hit that recession, you know, back in the late 2000s, the housing recession. We got clobbered. You know, we dropped down, and we've been coming back out of that, but we are still... we are nowhere near the level of housing that we were producing back then, and frankly, nowhere near the level of housing we should be producing just based on population growth and how many houses we need to house the folks moving to the community.
You know, we're going to have Laura Dorn on here in a week or so, and she's a realtor in the area, and she'll have some statistics. But I've seen some demographics, but Salem overall, if you go back to the 50s and 60s, we've really only grown like 2% a year. It's not unrestrained explosion of urban sprawl. Like some people want to claim that suddenly, you know, people just are You know, people like you're raping the earth and taking advantage, that kind of thing. But it's not that at all. I mean, 1 or 2% is nothing. That's where some of our kids are coming home after college, right? That's, and for a population that's 150,000, 450 seems like a really small number.
It is, and really, it's only I think a 1.2 or 1.3% growth rate. It's much, much smaller than it was in decades past.
And that's half of where they were in the mid-2000s.
Yeah, very much so.
Oh, goodness. So it may seem like a lot in your neighborhood where they're building because we have limited areas where we can build, right? So
correct.
Where's the activity taking place?
Yeah, so the activity is really, it's been a lot of South Salem, mm-hmm. has been a lot of the new construction activity. West Salem has seen a fair bit over recent years. But really, the area is constrained, the home building is constrained by the urban growth boundary. And so we've got this imaginary line, as we think about it, that's drawn around the community. And so it restricts where growth takes place and where it doesn't. And you mentioned sprawl a minute or two ago. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I've always said is we don't have sprawl here in Oregon under our urban growth boundary scenario. You know, if you fly over Atlanta or Houston, mm-hmm. you see sprawl.
Phoenix.
Yes, exactly. Right. But here we have a very constrained method of growth that's designed to prevent sprawl. And so, yes, we have growth, but it is absolutely not sprawl because we develop and we grow in a very orderly and very defined fashion to prevent that very thing from happening.
Dave, we're going to have to start a new file for dumb advocacy stories as well, because people who are advocating for no growth don't realize that, well, We're staying within the UGB, and so our urban growth boundary, and we talked about this a week or so ago, it's that line. It encompasses Salem and Kaiser and parts of it and some little bits that are outside the city limits, Corporal. But then they will protest against growth that's happening inside the urban growth boundary, but these are the lines that are containing and keeping us from going into the farmland.
Right.
These are the ones so we don't look like Phoenix, so we don't get on a super highway to go to the next neighborhood, right? So you can't have it both ways. We saw this 10 years ago with Hazel's Hill. Hazel Hill tried to incorporate into the city of Salem, and they said, no, there'll just be development and blah, blah, blah. Like, but it's in
the city.
It's in the urban growth boundary. So this is where you want us to grow.
Exactly.
So, all right. So those two areas, because that's where land is.
Yep.
Right?
Correct.
And in Northeast?
Yeah. Interestingly, we're actually seeing some new development in Northeast Salem, which is something that we have not seen, frankly, in the better part of probably 15 years.
Wow.
And so if folks have driven up and they're familiar with Cale Road that goes between really Portland Road out to Cordon Road, there is a new 720-lot subdivision that has been completed, and the first homes are being built out there. And really, it's probably the largest single subdivision that Salem has seen in decades, and it's taking place right there in Northeast Salem.
Is that in the city limits?
It is in the city limits.
Well, that's nice. There's huge chunks on the east side of town that are not in the city limits, and they've been... That's a whole other show. That's a whole other show.
don't get him started.
Politicians, not Mike. We won't do that to Mike. And then the Mushroom Factory. I used to live on Northeast over by Center and Cordon.
Yep.
So we experienced the Mushroom Factory back when it was still operational. And you know how you grow mushrooms.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Balls chickens.
I used to live out there as well, and I remember when they'd throw the doors open on the mushroom plant there in the afternoon, and the smell wafted over East Salem. So I think we can all be glad that is no longer there.
But it's been vacant. It's been idle. It's been fallow, right?
And that has been vacant for it must be close to almost 20 years. But what's taking place is there's a new development that has been proposed. My understanding is they're in the pre-application phase where they're talking to the city about what the conceptual plans are there. But I believe that will be close to as many as 700 or 800 lots there on the former site of the mushroom plant.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot of development. I think those will be perhaps a different kind of residential development than what we've seen in Salem traditionally. I think there'll be a much higher density. There'll be some attached housing, some duplexes, but really designed, I think, to meet the more affordable side of the market that's been very difficult for others to achieve, and they'll do it with density by doing a very attached and much more dense product than we're accustomed to seeing.
So attached like a townhome.
Correct.
Okay. And, well, that's great, because if we're going to fit more people inside the UGB, then we're going to have to do some things a little bit differently, including there was a change in the City of Salem regulations not that long ago to allow for accessory dwelling units, ADUs, right?
Correct.
Accessory dwelling
units.
It used to be mother-in-law's quarters, right? Which I think that's a great solution.
I'm all for that.
Yeah. Well, that's what you can take. If you've got a larger lot that was built a long time ago and you have, you know, you want to have extended family on the lot, or you want to build affordable housing for a Willamette student to, you know,
build a mini home in the back lot.
That's right. Accessory dwelling unit.
Could be a garage conversion. Somebody could be converting space that's already there. They could be building a new accessory structure on the site. But, you know, really, I don't think Salem's seen very much. If I recall, I think there's been less than 10 or 12 of those units in the entire past year.
Yeah, that's nice. At least give us an option. So Northeast Side, that's more growth on the Northeast Side than I would have guessed on Kale Road and mm-hmm. there on Cordon Road. And how is that going to impact Cordon Road?
Well, I don't think they're going to be going out towards Cordon. I think where they're going with that development is they're going to be targeting, in large part, folks that commute north to Portland. And I think anybody who's been paying attention to housing prices, both locally and up in Portland, knows that it's much more expensive to rent or to buy in the Portland area. It's, you know, a 30-50% premium. And, of course, folks can't afford to perhaps live in Portland, and so they are increasingly willing to make that drive to commute to work. And so whether that's going to Vancouver or going west to Forest Grove or east to Sandy, gosh, we've got a straight freeway shot right down here to Salem. And so I think where they're targeting that development will be in large part the commuters that are actually going north to the Portland area for work.
Okay, so the listener sitting there, he's like, why the heck can I not find a house for $250,000 even, where we used to be able to buy them sub $200,000. When the average home price was $200,000, it seemed really high in the Salem market. And now it's like $350,000 and up.
Well, I think the average new house is now over $400,000 in Salem.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah, it has gotten expensive. But really, that is being driven by the cost of land. And just the price of actually developing land into building lots is driving prices to the point where when a builder is going out there and buying a lot, they are typically spending $125,000 or more in the city of Salem to buy that lot. And so if you spent $125,000 to buy the land, and of course then you've got your impact fees and your building permits that you have to pay for, you're pretty close to $150,000 before you've even turned a scoop of dirt. And so just the cost of the land means that you're going to be building a house that has to sell for $400,000 or more. You can't build anything less than that.
And the price of the land is going up because of the urban growth boundary, right?
Well,
because it's limited land they can access.
There's a combination. It's certainly the UGB restricts supply,
right,
and that has driven costs up. But also, if you look at where is the land that we're developing inside the UGB, it's largely in West Salem and in South Salem. And those areas are hilly, and they're a lot more expensive to develop. Mm-hmm. And so whether that's the cost of regrading the subdivision, because, of course, in order to put the subdivision in, you have to have the streets in an orderly fashion. You have to create flat building sites or flat-ish building sites for the homes. And so it's
flat-ish.
A tremendous amount of cost. Exactly. It's a tremendous amount of cost to regrade those sites.
Yeah.
And so what we have now is the development parcels that are left in Salem inside the UGB have problems. They are difficult and they are expensive to develop. And so that really is driving the cost to the point where we're now spending, as I said, $125,000 or more for a lot.
We're going to talk more about those cost drivers and how hard it is and actually what a developer has to do to have that buildable lot at $125,000. So we've got in the studio Mike Erdman from the HBA. This is Brent here with Dave on Newsmakers 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This is Newsmakers with Brent and Dave on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
Welcome back to Newsmakers. This is Brent along with Dave and our guest Mike Erdman from the HBA. And we are talking all things regional housing today. So many things to talk about and affecting our Mid-Valley residents. We're talking a little bit about market and where they're building and some of the cost drivers and the cost of a lot. And I wanted to jump in right there that those lots that Mr. Erdman is talking about, those are buildable lots, right, Mike?
They are.
So that means that somebody, a developer, then we need a distinction for the listener. So there's a developer, and it may or may not be the person that builds a house, but the developer has gone in and had to put in a lot, had to grade it, had to put in the street, had to put in the sewer line, the stormwater lines, electrical, cable, and all that infrastructure with their money ahead of time. So it's very much front loaded.
Correct.
That's not something a lot of people don't realize. The city never puts in a new street.
No.
That's not, a city hasn't done that for years, right? It's done.
Or if they are doing streets, or if they're doing street widening, typically those are funded by system development charges that are paid for by the builders.
The builders pay the system development charges to pay for their share, fair share of growth, right? And that's determined through a formula and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so cost drivers for a lot and how much things cost. You mentioned $125,000 for a buildable lot, and then you mentioned that there are regulatory costs on top of that. SDCs, system right. development charges, are one of them. And what else?
Well, it's the costs that go into into making that lot so expensive, because of course the bare land itself is not representative of that full $125,000. But when the developer comes in and has to develop that lot, all the costs that go with that come with a lot of regulatory cost. And so there's a lot of compliance issues that could be stormwater compliance. It could be all the way down to ADA compliance. You wouldn't think about that. You know, we think about those with disabilities. But if a developer has to put in a lot, they have to, or put in a subdivision, they have to make the intersections within that subdivision flat. Even though the streets could be at, you know, a 15% grade, the intersections have to be flat. So a lot of cost in regrading an entire site to accomplish that, it drives that cost up.
And you mentioned stormwater, which is, you know, relatively new. Stormwater and sewer, not only community separate them, but we do in Salem.
We do, exactly. And so that is a new regulation courtesy of the city of Salem and the state on stormwater controls. And so new rules say that when a development goes in, they basically have to retain the stormwater on the site and make sure that it's not releasing water from that site any more than it would have done in its pre-development state.
What?
And then that water has to actually be clean as well. And so, of course, these are all aspirational things that we all look at and we think, oh, that's a good thing. We all want clean water. But at the same time, it costs a whole lot of money to do that. And so as you talk to our builders and developers, in some cases, they are spending more than $10,000 per lot just to put in that bioswale out front to capture that water, collect it, and treat it there on site.
Wow. Yikes.
And you wonder why there's no affordable housing. You know,
is that why you can't keep a rain barrel anymore?
I don't know.
I heard that.
Oh, I think that might be a plumbing code issue, just in terms of using the water that you collect from your roof.
You can't store it anymore?
Oh, I think you can store it, but you can't use it.
What?
Well, they want to make sure it doesn't get back into the city system.
No, I'm going to use it for my lawn.
That okay. I think you can do.
So you've got the Trade Association and a bunch of small business people employing a lot of people and generating cash in the industry. What kind of economic impact does the housing market have on our economy regionally?
Yeah, I mean, housing really is it's a big driver in the economy, which I don't think would surprise anybody. But I think it does surprise folks when they step back and they look at how much money is involved. We actually commissioned a study going back. It's been about 7 or 8 years, so it's a little bit out of date. But when you look at the numbers that they came up with, they said that with the number of homes we build in this community, it is producing about $200 million in economic activity in the community and about 3,000 local jobs. And that's just in the actual construction of the house. And then, of course, those construction workers going out and spending money in the restaurants and the stores, it drives a lot of activity. And so 3,000 jobs from the new home construction that we do every year, about $200 million in construction activity. It's about $15 million in local taxes and fees that go to state and local government. And then, of course, once the homes are occupied, of course, you have folks living there. And so discounting, not including the wages that those homeowners earn, but when they, in turn, are spending money in local stores, in local communities, it's about 500 jobs every year that come about from the increase in that population growth and the housing that comes with it. So there really is a tremendous amount of economic impact in the community from the construction of the new home and the residential growth that comes with it.
And some of the non-growth people, they don't like to hear this, but the axiom is true. You're either growing or you're dying as a community.
It is. And I've always said that. You know, there are a lot of folks that complain about growth, but I've really said there's really only two ways to stop growth. You can either make it so expensive that people can't afford to come here, or you can make the community so undesirable that people don't want to come here. And I don't think we want either of those scenarios. So we need to manage growth in a proper way. Because we want this to be a great community. We all live here, and we want that for folks that come here in the future, too.
It'd be nice if we included some of the members of the Salem City Council. So, sorry, that's still a zig there. So unattractive to live here, or so unaffordable to be able to live here, or maybe not have the infrastructure. So let's talk about the bridge. We've been talking about it a lot here, Dave and I. So how's that going to affect the West Salem housing and as far away as Dallas even?
Well, and I think the bridge is it's a big issue as we look at future development, because when you look at the urban growth boundary and where the vacant land is inside the UGB, a significant part of Salem's vacant land is in West Salem. Because as I said, Kaiser is effectively built out. East Salem, yes, there are a couple pockets there with the development of North Salem and the mushroom plant, but that's effectively built out because the UGB runs along Cordon Road. South Salem is getting closer to being built out, so the vacant land is west.
Right, and let me interject there that I think one of the reasons that West Salem, that's where the growth exists, because it's where the more problematic geography has been. So they've already used up a lot of the flatlands, and so that's why it's sitting out there and it seems to have the highest impact now. But you couldn't do it before because you had less expensive geography on which to build. Is that part of it?
No, absolutely. And so we talk about the bridge, of course. You know, when we develop, we need to have the infrastructure, whether that's the water lines or the sewer lines, the electricity lines. We also need transportation. And so if we're going to have the number of new homes that are slated for West Salem and other Polk County communities, we really do need that additional transportation link, because anybody who has commuted across that bridge in the morning and the evening knows that it is over capacity now. And so we can only imagine what that's going to be like 20 years or 30 years down the road when we've got a whole lot more folks living here. You know, we talked about West Salem, but of course the bridge serves the Polk County communities too. And Polk County is growing even faster than what we're seeing here in Salem. Interestingly, think about the city of Dallas, which is what, 10% the population of Salem. City of Dallas permitted, I think, more than 30% the number of homes that Salem did last year.
Wow.
And so Dallas
growing
is growing.
Three times as fast.
It is. Yeah. It's growing effectively three times as fast. And Independence is seeing the same thing. So a lot of folks are going out to our smaller communities, whether it's Dallas, Independence, Monmouth, Sublimity, Staten, because as prices go up here in Salem, they go to the surrounding communities because they can perhaps find a little larger lot. Perhaps they find something that's a little less expensive. They're willing to make that commute. Just as we talked about earlier, folks willing to perhaps come to Salem because they can commute more affordably to Portland. We see folks here doing the same thing, going to those surrounding communities because they're able to save money on their own housing.
Well, all right. So are we going to be able to build more houses in West Salem if there's no bridge? And we're talking about the planned bridge that is not built, that we don't have the infrastructure for, that our current city council is trying to kill next month, actually, January.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind the 15 years and $8 million put into it and the regional effort. But that's beside the point, right? Yeah, it doesn't matter. So infrastructure, you're talking about infrastructure, and I'll put in a sideline here. That's like saying we should be using so much fresh water, so we're purposely going to build undersized sewer drains, so that if you flush the toilet, it backs up, so it makes it unpleasant for people to use fresh water. Let's build less infrastructure. I mean, it's exactly the same in terms of infrastructure for the citizens. You have transportation is absolutely one of them. Just like water moving, water going, streets and everything else, they want to underbuild the transportation infrastructure.
Well, and the same folks are the ones that are saying we need to plan for growth and we need smart growth are the very ones now saying, let's not plan for growth. We know the growth is going to take place. It has to go there. And they're saying we refuse to plan for the infrastructure needs of the community.
Okay, I've got one more regulatory thing to hit you on, rent control. And I studied this back in the early 80s in college, and that was being taught from a liberal university, mind you, that the rent control was a failed experiment. It was a failed social experiment because it didn't have the desired outcomes they anticipated it did, because what it did is it created slums and slumlords, mm-hmm. because there was no incentive to put more money into your building because you're never going to get the money out of your building. So what do we look at? I mean, then I hear it talking about in Oregon, you know, 30, 40 years later, they're really considering rent control in the same kind of fashion or different fashion?
Yeah, I think they are, and I think it's going to be a big topic in the 2019 legislative session. Rent control is going to be one of the hot issues. And while it's not a direct home building issue per se, it certainly affects the housing market. And so if you're going to limit how much somebody can increase their rents, it really runs the risk of having underinvested properties that somebody cannot reinvest in and bring back up to what we'd all like to see in the community, because they can't recapture that in the rents. And so if you have a perhaps a small mom and pop type landlord, they've got a smaller apartment complex, maybe they've got 15 or 18 units, they haven't invested in it. Gosh, the roof desperately needs to be redone. They've got a whole bunch of other deferred maintenance issues. and somebody else comes in, they want to buy that project, they want to fix it up, make it an improvement in the community, something we can all be proud of. But if you can't raise the rents to pay for those kind of improvements, exactly like you say, Brent, we're ending up in slumlord type territory, because you just have projects that fall apart and they can't recapture the rents necessary to fix it up.
That means they don't even invest in the inside either, upgrading appliances and carpets and things like that, right?
Exactly.
It's a textbook case of how to create a slum. All right, we got one more segment here coming up with Mike Erdman from the HBA. A few more things to talk about. We'll be right back here on Newsmakers 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
Newsmakers continues with Brent DeHart and Dave Bourne on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
Right over my head, Dave, is that House of Blues? What is it?
It is Roadhouse Blues from Roadhouse the Blues. Doors.
All right. Thank you for sticking with the
You're giving me
theme.
The Roadhouse Blues.
Talking about housing. This is Brent DeHart with Dave Bourne here at KYKN. Mike Erdman, thank you for coming in today. I was just saying during the break how fast we both talk, and it's obviously a topic that interests us both. I have a lot of passion for. We're talking about some of the cost drivers and the cost of the lots and why they're so expensive. And I recall prior to the recession, lot costs were going over $75,000, and it was just crazy what they were getting for lots and pushing upwards to $100,000. And now it's like in Salem, probably Kaiser as well, $125,000 if it's a billable lot. And you have to go to as far as I've got a friend building in Sweet Home. And those lots are so much less expensive, you know, bought a long time ago and less expensive, to build a house that's under $200,000, if that's even possible. Is it?
Well, not in Salem right now. Perhaps for folks who bought in some of those small communities many years ago and got the land a whole lot cheaper, maybe they can get closer to it, but that's a stretch. I'd be surprised if somebody could get down below $200,000.
Well, and don't even get me started on how to get a home loan anymore and what that loan process is. That's a whole other topic. We'll have to bring somebody in.
That's a lot of hoops is what that is.
So, Mike Erdman, tell me a little bit about materials, because we were hearing out there that Trump tariffs was going to destroy wood product costs and things, you know, the cost to build the houses. What's going on with the cost of the materials to build the houses?
Yeah, certainly the cost of land is driving housing costs, but it's not the only thing driving it. Material costs are going up. Labor is going up. You mentioned the Trump tariffs. The Trump administration put, I think it was a 22% tariff on Canadian softwood lumber at the start of last year, and that drove lumber costs up significantly. And I think it was close to about $10,000 a house, just the impact of the tariffs. And lumber prices went up, multiple times that. I think it was close to 60%. Those seem to have peaked maybe June or July of this year, and those have come back down. So that has eased some, which has helped. But at the same time, there are other materials that continue to increase. Certainly lighting and other types of things that come from China are affected by the tariffs. But labor is, frankly, one of the biggest challenges that folks have right now in terms of housing production and the costs that go into it. We just do not have enough folks working in the construction trades as we need to build the houses.
So what do we do about it?
Well, that's a good question. There's no easy answers, that's for sure. But I think it's important to invest in programs like CTEC with the Salem-Kaiser School District and what they're doing to introduce the trades to the high school kids. Mm-hmm. But there's no easy solution. A lot of folks have looked at it. A lot of investment's gone into it. But it's a structural problem that's going to take a lot of time to address.
So are your members having to do on-the-job training and teach people how to tape measures and frame a house and pour concrete?
Well, to some degree. Certainly, finding the skilled labor is the challenge. And so certainly if somebody can come on and perhaps start in one of the lesser skilled jobs, more of a laborer, then certainly folks will invest that training and time to bring them up to skill. That's important, but that takes time. And we need folks right now that have those skills to build the houses.
Dave, I don't know if you've looked for somebody, an electrician or a plumber recently, and been told what their schedule is like, the heating and cooling, remodel your home, mm-hmm. and all those things. There's people that do the work, but it takes so long.
It does. I even have a friend who does that, and his schedule was so busy, it took him 2 weeks to get to my house.
So we've talked a lot today about affordable houses and how do you have affordable houses so a young family can get in. It's not just about...
small single family.
Yeah, we're not even just talking about subsidized housing, about government subsidized housing for low-income people and welfare and things. We're talking about a starter house. Are you going to start at $350,000?
You know, you can still get houses below $350,000.
Just new ones.
Oh, you can get new houses below $350,000, but that's probably about as
but how small
is it? At the bottom end of the market. Yeah, probably, you know, 1,600-1,700 square feet, perhaps.
That's a good size.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to circle back around. You're talking about the economic impact of your industry and those home builders and all those small businesses. And Oregon's a small business state, and we're a small business region. As a small business person myself, I look in terms of what kind of risks are they taking? You know, sure, you know, they're making money now, but they're taking the risk that the economy turns, especially if they're building a house that hasn't been sold yet. And a lot of people lost a lot of shirts in 2009, 2010.
Yeah.
So they take the risk that, you know, regulation can turn against them. The cost of materials can change after they've already bid a job. You know, they can hit the big recession. In some ways, it's kind of like farmers. The industry is a lot like farmers, who we adore, of course. It's like if something turns in the cost of and the market for blueberries, the market for wheat, the farmer can have a bust and boom. And your industry is subject to bust and boom, right?
Yeah, very much. It's a very capital intensive industry, and it's a lengthy process. And so if somebody's looking to build homes, they may be looking to buy lots even a couple years out into the future. And so when you're making that kind of investment and taking on that kind of borrowing, because of course lots are so expensive, there's inherent risks. And if that market turns and you're left holding the bag, so to speak, when the market drops, you could be in a world of hurt financially.
And the labor shortage you're talking about, I think, is directly resulted to how many people had to leave the industry in 2009, 10, 11.
I know, right? One. Yeah. He doesn't do home building anymore. He was, yeah. He was a builder. Yeah.
And they had to leave the industry, and the people that left scraped through, and now we're kind of at least at some part of a boom cycle, but we lost a lot of people, and they had to go find work in other industries, and they're not back.
Mm-hmm. He sold everything he had.
Let's use trusses, for example. So those things that hold up your roof, right?
Right.
And a lot of companies went out of business in the recession. And so the few companies that survived it that are still here, they're really they're just so backlogged.
No, you hit it right on. There's folks that left the industry. They found other lines of employment, and they have not come back.
Wow. All right. What else do you want our industry to know about the HBA and your membership? Ways the HBA might be able to help in terms of elucidating the general public or the elected public, some of the roles that people would be surprised that you offered.
Well, sure. I mean, we advocacy. Do a lot for the industry. Yes, we talked about the advocacy. But at the same time, we do offer a lot of benefit to the consumers. We do a lot of referrals. And so we take quite a few phone calls to our office for folks that are looking for a contractor, and they may not know who to go to, whether they're perhaps remodeling their house or looking to build. And so we're certainly able to give referrals to folks and kind of point them in the right direction. That's important. Of course, we have a couple of consumer home shows we do out at the state fairgrounds in January and March.
Those are fun.
Yes. A lot of folks love coming out to that. We do the tour of homes that comes up every June. And in fact, we haven't made this public. I guess we'll make it public now.
All right. You heard it here first.
We're going to be unveiling a tour of remodeled homes in September of next year. So very excited about that.
Ooh, I'd like to see that, actually.
So it's like the third week in January, we can go look for things to do for our home.
Second week in January, the 11th to the 13th.
All right. And if we're looking for a tradesman and we don't know where to go and we don't know who to trust, we can call the Trade Association, the Home Builders Association of Marion Polk County, the HBA, and ask for a referral to one of your members.
Absolutely.
And you will know how long they've been in business and how long they've been in members and so forth.
Correct. We can kind of find out a little bit more about what they're looking for and try to match them up. They can call us 503-399-1500, or they can go to our website, which is homebuildersassociation.org.
That's 399-1500, right?
That is it.
Try it with your radio voice.
399-1500.
I liked it better the first time. We're talking to Mike Erdman here at KYKN Newsmakers. You're doing an hour to talk about local topics. Wow. Information-packed hour. I really thank you for being here. That is information of great interest to so many of us who are putting down roots and raising families and investing in businesses in the Mid-Valley. Mike Erdman with the Marion Polk Home Builders Association talking all things housing. We thank you for joining us. This is Brent DeHart along with Dave Bourne. We're going to talk about some more dumb government stories tomorrow at 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This has been Newsmakers with Brent DeHart and Dave Bourne, presented by Les Schwab Tires on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.